as though in a gesture of welcome. Thin, sharp spines like porcupine's needles began to grow from her metal skin, each capped with a red knob like a pinhead, spaced a few inches apart, and extending from her face, her body, and her arms and legs. They grew slowly outward, lining up perfectly with one another to create a false contour all around her body. The girl looked expectantly at Jessica.
"Give it a minute," the girl said. "Let your eyes adjust."
The humming sound grew louder, rising higher in pitch until it became painful to hear. Jessica covered her ears, but it did nothing to dampen the sound. Suddenly, a new image snapped into place. Where the smooth, slim, red-headed animatronic had been was a gigantic, cartoonish child, her green eyes too large for her face, and her nose and cheeks painted a garish pink. She was a perfect image of the girl on the neon sign. Before Jessica could react, the childish image vanished, the needle-like extensions snapping back into the girl's body with a metallic snap. The humming stopped. The animatronic girl had returned to her former appearance. William Afton watched her with a gleam of pride. Jessica turned again to the sleek, shiny girl standing at the man's side.
"How did you create her?"
Jessica asked, her eyes filled with curiosity for a moment before snapping herself back to the immediate danger surrounding her.
"Ah, a woman with a mind for science. You can't help but to admire what I've done."
He braced himself on one arm of the chair, hoisting himself up to sit straighter.
"Although..."
He looked up at the gleaming girl for a moment, then turned away.
"I can't take complete credit for this, unfortunately."
He reclined his head again and let out a sigh.
"Sometimes great things come at a great cost."
Jessica waited for him to go on, confused, then looked at the animatronic girl, recalling all that she'd said minutes before.
"I am a brilliant man, make no mistake, but what you see before you is a combination of all sorts of machinations and magic. My only real accomplishment was making something that could walk."
He reached out and tapped the leg of the animatronic standing at his side. She did not react.
"No small accomplishment, although it's not happening as fluidly as you think. A lot of what you see is just in your head."
He wheezed a laugh, then stopped himself, ending with a pained cough before going on.
"That was Henry's idea, not to try to reinvent the wheel. Why try to create the illusion of life when your mind can do it for us?"
"She's more than an illusion, though," Jessica said plainly.
"Quite right," Afton answered thoughtfully. "Quite right. But that's why we're here, to discover the secret of that last ingredient, what you might call the spark of life."
"Is that why I'm here, too?"
Jessica clenched her jaw.
"I believe you came here of your own free will, didn't you?"
Afton said mildly.
"I didn't tie myself up."
"But I certainly didn't put you in the trunk of that car," he answered. "We would rather have had your friend Charlie," he continued. "But we can find a use for you."
He closed his eyes for a long moment, then opened them, meeting Jessica's eyes.
"I have faced my own mortality, Jessica. I knew I was dying, and through every broken fragment of my body, I was profoundly, immeasurably afraid. I fear it more than I fear life like this, even when every waking instant is pain, and sleep is possible only when induced by enough medication to kill most people.
Everyone is afraid to die, Jessica said, and you should be more afraid than anyone else, because if there's a hell, there's a hole at the bottom of it reserved for you.
Afton nodded with a moment of honest resignation.
In time, I'm sure that's where I will find myself. But the devil has knocked on my door before, and I've turned him away.
He smiled.
So what? You want to live forever?
William Afton smiled sadly and held out his hand to the animatronic girl. She went to him and put a protective hand on his shoulder.
Certainly not like this, he said.
Jessica glanced at the robot girl, then back to the man in front of her, his body already riddled with mechanical parts.
So, what? You're making yourself into a robot?
She laughed nervously, then stopped at his grave expression.
I didn't realize that you fancied yourself a mad scientist.
No, that's science fiction, he said, unamused.
The plastic tarp moved again and began to slide off the table, but stopped, not revealing what lay underneath.
Everyone dies.
Jessica blinked. The adrenaline was wearing off, and she was beginning to feel exhausted. Afton reached up and touched the mechanical girl's cheek, then turned his attention back to Jessica.
The most terrible accidents sometimes bear the most beautiful fruits, he said, as if to himself. Recreating the accident, that is the duty and the honor of science, to replicate the experiment and obtain the same result. I give my life to this experiment, piece by piece.
He nodded at the girl, and she approached Jessica with deliberate steps. Jessica backed away, fear surging again.
What are you going to do to me?
She could hear the urgency in her own voice.
Please, enough. As a woman of science, at least try to appreciate what I've done, Afton said.
I study archaeology, she said in a flat tone.
He didn't respond. The girl stepped closer, giving her an unreadable stare. The plastic tarp slid from the table, and Jessica startled and stared at what was underneath, but her terror turned to confusion in an instant. There wasn't a body, not human or machine. Instead, there was a melted scrap heap, whose extensions could be interpreted as arms and legs, but with no defined mechanism of movement. There were no joints, no muscles, no skin or coverings, just masses of undefined tangles and cords, melted into one another and fused together. Most of it seemed fused to the table, burned and blackened at the edges where it touched the table itself, melting into it and seemingly inseparable from it.
I don't understand.
Jessica's mouth hung open, and she sat down again without thinking.
Good girl.
Afton smiled thinly. Jessica clenched her jaw. The animatronic girl went back to the table and took up the cotton balls and rubbing alcohol. She started with her fingers again, methodically wiping down each one.
Get on with it, Afton said impatiently.
The girl did not break her deliberate pace.
I touched you. I have to start over, she said.
Nonsense. Just do it. I've survived worse than this.
The risk of infection, she said calmly.
Elizabeth, he snapped. Do as I say.
The animatronic girl stopped moving at once, looking startled, and for a moment almost seemed to tremble. Jessica held her breath, wondering if anyone knew or cared that she had just heard the exchange. The girl immediately regained her composure, her eyes relaxing, then opened the drawer and took out a pair of rubber gloves, which she fitted easily over her metal hands. He settled back, and the girl came to him and bent over to press a button on the side of his chair. The chair made a pneumatic hiss and reclined, flattening out like a bed, and the girl placed her foot on a lever at the chair's base. She stepped on it, and the chair jerked upward. Afton made a pained grunt, and Jessica winced reflexively. The girl hit the lever again, yanking the chair up another inch, then stopped and flipped the monitor back on. It began to beep again at slightly irregular intervals, and she levered the chair up rapidly, jolting Afton's frail body as it rose. The girl darted her eyes from the monitor to Afton and back again, attentive to his vital signs. When the chair reached waist height, she stepped back, apparently satisfied. Afton let out a rattling breath, then lifted his hand an inch to point at Jessica. "Come closer," he said. She took a small step, and he curled his lips in a smile or a sneer. "I want you to watch what happens next," he said.
"What's going to happen next?" Jessica asked, hearing her own voice shake.
"How did the creatures at Freddy's move, of their own will, with no outside force controlling them?" he asked mildly.
He tilted his head, waiting.
"The children were still inside. Their souls were inside those creatures," she said, the words brittle.
She felt brittle, like if anything touched her now, she might easily break apart. Afton sneered again.
"Oh, Jessica, come now. What else?"
She closed her eyes. What is he talking about?
"What else was inside them to bind their spirits so inseparably to the bear, to the rabbit, to the fox? How did they die, Jessica?"
Jessica gasped, covering her mouth with both hands, as if she could stop herself from knowing as long as she did not speak.
"How, Jessica?" Afton demanded, and she lowered her hands, trying to steady her breath.
"You killed them," she said, and he made an impatient sound.
She met his eyes again, not flinching from the empty socket.
"They died in the suits," she said hoarsely. "Their bodies were bound inside, along with their souls."
He nodded.
"The spirit follows the flesh, it would seem, and also the pain. If I wish to become my own immortal creation, my body must lead my spirit to its eternal home. Since I am still experimenting, I move my flesh piece by piece."
He looked thoughtfully over at the creature on the table.
"More and more," he murmured, almost to himself. "It is a test of the strength of my own will. How much of myself can I carve away and still remain in control?"
"Carve away?" Jessica repeated faintly, and he snapped his attention back to her.
"Yes, I will even allow you to watch," he said with a smirk.
"No thanks," she said, shrinking back, and he wheezed a laugh.
"You will watch," he said, then gestured to the animatronic girl. "Keep an eye on her," Afton said.
"I have many eyes on her."
The girl went to a cabinet and took out another IV bag. Before she closed the door, Jessica caught a glimpse of more like it, and a shelf of what looked like vacuum-sealed cuts of meat. Her stomach flipped, and she swallowed hard. Jessica started to squirm in her seat. There was a hissing sound coming from somewhere, and a smell of burning oil began to fill the room. The table where the mass of metal rested was beginning to glow orange at its center, and the mass on the table seemed to move slightly, although only out of the corner of Jessica's eye. Jessica snapped back to attention and turned toward Afton. He appeared to be asleep. His chest rose and fell with slow breaths, and his eyes were closed. His eyelid draped loosely over the steel rod in the center of his missing eye, the thin skin hanging into the empty socket. The girl nodded and moved to the table. Jessica swallowed, the rotten smell swelling around her. She had ceased to notice it, her nose tuning it out. But now it was everywhere, thickening the air with its miasma. An operating theater. He's harvesting the kids for organs, transplanting them into himself? Jessica looked around the room, calculating. The scalpels were too far away to grab, and they wouldn't even scratch the animatronic girl's paint. If she ran, she would be dead before she was halfway to the door. Jessica forced herself to watch. The animatronic girl went to William Afton's side, then checked the monitor again with care. She unbuttoned his pajama top and splayed it open, revealing his chest and the massive scars that had covered it since before he went by the name Dave. The girl tugged the waist of his pants an inch lower so that his torso was fully exposed, then nodded, took off her gloves, and replaced them with new ones. Then she took up one of the scalpels. Jessica looked away. "You have to watch," the girl said, her voice chilling, a human voice stripped of human intonation. Jessica jerked her head up. The animatronic's eyes were on her. "He wants to see you watch," she repeated, the pleasant veneer cloaking her voice once more. Jessica gulped and nodded, fixing her eyes on the scene before her. "I don't think you understand," the girl said. "Go wash your hands." Shakily, Jessica got to her feet and went to the sink, feeling as if she might pass out at any moment. She turned the sink on and watched the water spiral down the drain, the shiny stainless steel gleaming through in the bright light. "Wash your hands." Jessica obeyed, pushing up her sleeves above her elbows and washing her hands all the way up the forearms, foaming up the soap over and over as she had seen doctors do on TV. She rinsed them finally and turned to the animatronic girl. "What am I doing?" she asked. The girl ripped open a plastic package and took out a towel. She held it out to Jessica. "You're going to help." Jessica took the towel and dried her hands, then put on gloves from the box the animatronic girl directed her to. "You know this thing isn't sterile, right?" she muttered, glancing at the mass on the table. "Wait!" Jessica gasped and took a step toward the table. From this angle, she could see more of its form. It was a melted mess, but she could recognize certain elements in the mass of fused scrap on the table. A leg, a finger, an eye socket. I recognize these parts," Jessica said, but there was no answer. "These look like endoskeletons from Freddy's, the original Freddy's." Jessica began calculating in her head, measuring to herself how much this mass must weigh, and its size relative to the size of the endoskeletons she remembered. Before she could think further, the creature on the table attempted to lift its leg, the makeshift knee bending partially. There was no mechanical device that she could make out. It seemed to be moving of its own will. After a second, it dropped back to the table. "Where did you find these?" Jessica stepped back. "Where did you find these? What did you do? Why did you melt them all together?" "Hand me the scalpel," the girl said patiently. The surgical implements were laid out in a neat row on the rolling table, on a piece of paper, along with a set of curved needles already threaded, and a small, kitchen-size propylene torch. The creature on the table tried again to lift its leg, and suddenly Jessica understood how it was able to move.
"They're still in there!" Jessica screamed. "The children! Michael!"
The creature writhed pitifully, as if responding to her voice, and Jessica's heart wrenched.
"They're in there, and they're in pain."
"I guess I should have kidnapped Marla if I wanted a nurse," the girl said sardonically. "I told you. He wants you to watch. Look over here." Jessica obeyed, feeling her head go light as the girl pressed the scalpel into Afton's skin. "Don't pass out." She drew the blade across his lower abdomen with steady, practiced hands, making a 6-inch incision. She held out the scalpel, and Jessica stared for a moment before realizing she was supposed to take it. "He wants you to watch. It's the only reason you're alive. If you don't watch, then there is no reason for you to be here. Do you understand?" Jessica steadied herself. "Breathe. Don't faint. Think about something else. John, Charlie, no, I'll start crying. Something else, something else. Shoes, black boots, knee-high, the kind that look like riding boots, Italian leather." Jessica took the scalpel and set it down where it had been, and the blood dripped onto the paper, seeping into the fibers. Jessica took another deep breath. The animatronic girl had one of her hands inside the incision and was pulling it back, peering into the wound she had just made. "Scalpel," she said again, and Jessica picked up a new one and handed it to her. "Watch," the girl warned, and Jessica watched as she reached into the incision and cut something inside. Jessica flinched. "Shoes, maroon clogs, chunky heel, 3 inches, patchwork stitching." The girl held out the scalpel, her hand still inside Afton's body. "Take it. Give me clamps." Jessica took the scalpel and replaced it. "Clamps?" she asked, starting to panic as she searched among the instruments. "They look like scissors, with teeth instead of blades. Open them and hand them to me, and do it fast." "Shoes, jelly sandals, purple, sparkly." Jessica grabbed the clamps and tried to open them, but they were stuck together, hooked by an odd clasp at the top. "Hurry up! Do you want him to die?" "Yes, I do," Jessica wanted to shout, but held her tongue. She pinched the scissor handles together, and they came free. She handed them to the girl, relieved, and watched as she stuck the pointed end into the opening and pinched whatever she had been holding, clamping it shut. She took her hand slowly out of the wound and looked at Jessica. "You have to be faster. Scalpel. Then I'll need clamps right away." Jessica nodded. "Shoes. Green suede kitten heels with a rhinestone strap at the ankle." She handed the girl the scalpel, then wrestled the clamps open as fast as she could, and was holding them out by the time the bloody blade was returned to her. She watched dizzily as the animatronic girl made another cut, severing something she could not see, and using the last set of clamps to hold it shut. The table behind them began to hiss more loudly, and the orange glow intensified. Jessica took a step sideways to get away from the heat. The glow spread to the creature on the table, and parts of it seemed to turn from side to side. "Hold out your hands," the girl said. "Platform sneakers, denim, hideous." Jessica held out her hands for the clamps, but the girl left them in place. Instead, she slid both hands into Afton's open body
and lifted out a bloody object. His kidney. That's his kidney. Black leather combat boots. Black leather combat boots. Charlie's black leather combat boots. The animatronic girl held the kidney up in the air for a moment, and blood dripped from it onto her face. Charlie's boots. Charlie. The girl turned to Jessica, and she shrank back. Hold out your hands, the girl repeated with cold insistence, and Jessica obeyed, fighting not to retch as the warm organ was placed gently in her hands. It's meat. It's not part of a person. Just think of it as meat. Platform sneakers, stiletto boots, penny loafers. She watched in a daze as the girl took a curved needle and black thread and began to sew William Afton back together, starting with his innards and ending with the first incision, making a row of X's across the left half of his body. At last she finished, snipping the last thread off with practiced ease. What's next? Jessica asked, her voice sounding faint against the rushing in her ears. Yellow sneakers with a blue streak on the side. Those brown pumps Mom got me. Oh, Mom. The next part is easy, the girl said, pulling the gloves off and picking the kidney up again with her hand and approaching the table where the mass lay. What are you going to do? Jessica quivered. What did you think all of this was for? The girl said softly. He told you. Piece by piece. Jessica looked down at the creature on the table, glowing orange at its core, and dripping fluid from its various parts, the drops landing with a hiss on the hot surface. This is a transplant, she said. The mass of melted parts for a moment looked human, its demeanor suddenly childlike as it squirmed, and its head turned to face Jessica. For just a moment, Jessica thought she could make out eyes looking back at her. Suddenly, the silence was broken as the animatronic girl clenched her fist around the kidney and slammed it against the creature's chest, pressing so hard that the metal underneath sank inward, embedding the kidney deep inside where it gurgled and hissed. More fluid seeped out the sides of the creature and burned on the table, as the girl wrenched it back and forth inside. She pulled her hand from the cavity she had created, her hand charred black, and rested it at her side, extending and retracting her fingers as though making sure they still worked. Now we are done, she said. She brushed past Jessica and went to the cabinet and emerged with a long needle. She strode purposefully to William Afton's side, stopped with her fist raised over her head, then brought the needle down, plunging it into his chest. A second passed, then he heaved an enormous breath and groaned. The girl pulled the needle from his chest and set it gently on the table beside him. William Afton opened his eyes, and his single eyeball moved back and forth between Jessica and the animatronic girl.
Is it done? He asked.
Jessica screamed. The intensity of it roused her from her daze, and she screamed again, letting the sound drown out everything else. Her throat went raw, but she screamed again, clinging to the roar of her own voice. For an instant, she felt like if she kept screaming, nothing worse could happen. The air around the girl shimmered, and Jessica's vision blurred in front of her. Something was moving. In a moment, her eyes cleared, and Charlie was standing in front of her.
Jessica, don't worry. You can trust me, Charlie said cheerfully.
Chapter 9. A hand was stroking her hair. The sun was going down over a field of grain. A cluster of birds were fluttering overhead, their calls echoing out over the landscape.
I'm so happy to be here with you,
a kind voice said. She looked up and nestled against him. Her father smiled down at her, but there were tears in his eyes.
Don't cry, Daddy, she wanted to say, but when she tried to speak, the words did not come.
She reached up to touch his face, but her hand passed through empty air. He was gone, and she was alone in the grass. Overhead, the birds began to wail, and their calls sounded like human voices, breaking with despair.
Daddy!
Charlie screamed, but there was no answer, only the birds' lamentation as the sun vanished beyond the horizon. It was dark, and he had not come back. All the birds were gone but one, and that one sounded more human with every cry. Charlie stood unsteadily. By some trick of time, she was no longer a child, but a teenage girl, and the fields around her had turned to rubble. She stood in the midst of a ruined place, but there was a single wall standing in front of her, and a door at the center of it. The birds were silent, but someone was crying on the other side of the door, crying alone in a small, cramped space. She ran to it, banging her fists on the metal surface.
Let me in, she cried. Let me in! I have to get inside!
I have to get inside! Charlie sat bolt upright with a ragged gasp, inhaling like she'd just escaped from drowning. The doors. The closet. She threw off the gray wool blanket and sheets, tangling herself in the process before she managed to get free. She was so hot she could barely stand it, and the wool had been scratching where it touched her chin. She felt strange, more alert. The world was in sharp focus, and it was jarring, as if she had been drifting in some kind of shadowy, half-conscious state for days. Everything hurts, she'd managed to whisper to John, but it had been somehow detached from her. There was some buffer between her body and her mind. Now, her mind clear, the buffer was gone, and she ached all over, a dull, constant pain that seemed to be everywhere at once. She leaned back against the wall. She had not woken to sleepy disorientation. She knew exactly where she was. She was in John's apartment, behind the couch. She was behind the couch because... Someone is impersonating me, she said uncertainly, and the sound of her own voice was startling in the empty room. She got to her knees, not quite trusting her legs, then steadied herself on the back of the couch, getting to her feet with effort. She straightened and was instantly dizzy, her head swimming as her knees threatened to buckle under her. Charlie gripped the back of the couch determinedly, picking a point on the wall and staring at it, willing the room to stop spinning. After a moment, it did, and Charlie realized the wall she was staring at was a door. Doors. The thought made her lightheaded again, but she kept a firm hand on the couch and made her way around to the front, then sat down on it carefully. She glanced around the room. So far, all she had seen was the corner behind the sofa. The shades were pulled down, and she could see that the front door was bolted. Charlie lost interest in the rest of it, her eyes drawn back to the other door. It was scarcely ajar, the room behind it dark, and Charlie shivered, echoes of her dream reverberating in her head. Doors. Someone was on the other side. Behind the door, somewhere small and dark. I was drawing them, doors. I had to find the door. Then, she closed her eyes, remembering. They were running, desperate to get away as the building thundered around them, already falling to pieces when she saw the door. The door called to me. It was hidden in the wall, but I went to it. I knew exactly where it was. As I walked toward it, it was like I was on both sides, walking to it and trapped behind it, separated from myself. When I touched it, I could feel the beating of your heart, and then... Charlie's eyes snapped open. John pulled me away, she said, the memory solidifying as she let herself dwell on it. I didn't want to go because... She heard it, suddenly, the hiss and the cracks appearing in the wall. Because the door had started to open. Charlie stood, her eyes glued to the door in John's living room. She approached it as if propelled by the same instinctive force, her heart picking up its pace. It's just the bedroom, right? She murmured, but still she edged toward it slowly. She stopped in front of the door and reached out tentatively, vaguely surprised when her fingers touched real wood. She pushed it gently, and it swung open easily, revealing a girl identical to Charlie. A mirror. She looked the same. Her face was pale and strained, but it was her face, and she smiled instinctively. In the haze of the last few days, weeks, she had been utterly disoriented, fading in and out of consciousness, pain finding her even in dreams. Charlie had not felt like herself, but there she was. She reached out to touch the mirror girl's hand. You are you, she said quietly. Behind her came the unmistakable sound of a lock being turned, and she whirled around in sudden panic, losing her balance and catching herself on John's dresser. The front door opened and she shrank back, kneeling to let the dresser shield her. A clamor of voices burst in, all talking at once. There were too many to make out the words, until a familiar voice called, Charlie? Charlie didn't move, waiting to be sure. Footsteps came to the doorway of the bedroom, then the voice again. Charlie? Marla, Charlie answered. I'm here. She started to get up, but her legs would not take her weight. I can't, she started, tears of frustration pricking her eyes as Marla hurried over. It's okay, Marla said hurriedly. It's okay, I'll help. It's amazing you made it this far. Charlie looked at her flatly, and Marla laughed. I'm sorry, she said. It's just glaring at me like that. You're so... What? Charlie. Who else am I supposed to be? Charlie smiled as Marla took hold of her wrist with medical authority and began to silently count. She looked past Marla to Carlton, who came over quickly. John was standing in the door, but he made no move to join them, not meeting Charlie's eyes. I didn't want to crowd you, Carlton said, sitting down beside her and crossing his legs. Charlie, I'm... He broke off and swallowed, looking away. I'm really glad to see you, he said to the floor. I'm glad to see you too, Charlie said. She looked back to Marla, who nodded briskly. Your pulse is a little slow, she said. I want to check it again in a few minutes. I want you to drink some water. Charlie nodded. Okay, she said bemusedly. Let's get her onto the bed, Marla said to Carlton, who nodded and, before Charlie could protest, scooped her up into his arms. Charlie glanced around for John, but he had disappeared. Marla pulled the blankets back. Charlie felt the pull of sleep, like something standing behind her, gently tugging. She blinked rapidly, trying to rouse herself as Carlton set her down. Marla started to pull the blankets over her, and Charlie waved her hands, ineffectually trying to push them away. I'm too hot, she said, and Marla stopped. Okay, she said. They're here if you need them. Charlie nodded. The tugging was growing stronger. If she just closed her eyes, she would slip back into the dark. Marla and Carlton were talking to each other, but it was getting harder to keep track of what they were saying. A loud bang rattled the small apartment, and Charlie jolted awake, her heart thudding alarmingly. Almost instantly, Marla's hand was on her shoulder.
"It's just John," she said. "I think my heart rate is back up," Charlie said, attempting to joke, but Marla turned on her with appraising eyes, grabbed her wrist, and started to count again.
"Marla, I'm fine," Charlie said, half-heartedly pulling away. Marla held on for another few seconds, then released her. In the living room, John set something down on the floor with force. Carlton gave Charlie a concerned glance, then helped her off the bed, giving her an arm to lean on as they went out into the living room to join John. For a moment, the object was obscured. Then they all moved aside so she could see the child-sized doll. Charlie sat down on the floor, a little apart from the others.
"Ella," she whispered.
Some tight, painful knot inside her chest began to loosen, and she felt herself smile.
"John, how did you find her?" she asked.
John knelt down behind the doll and looked up at her grimly, and her smile faded.
"What's wrong?"
she asked. He didn't answer her.
"Everyone, keep your eyes on the doll," he said instead, and took something out of his pocket.
He flicked his thumb against the object, a tiny motion, and the air around Ella shimmered for a moment, blurring her. Charlie rubbed her eyes and heard Marla gasp. Ella was gone. Standing where she had been was a little girl about 3 years old, dressed in Ella's clothes. The knot in Charlie's chest started to tighten again.
"What is this, John?" Marla asked sharply.
John flicked his thumb again, and the shimmer passed over the girl. Then she was a doll again, her vacant eyes staring placidly into eternity. Charlie darted her eyes from one to the next. Marla looked scared, but Carlton was fascinated. John, for some reason, seemed angry. Charlie shifted uneasily. John manipulated the object in his hand again, and the little girl appeared once more. Carlton crouched down to look at her, and Marla bent down to see, keeping her distance. John stood, leaving them to stare at Ella, and knelt beside Charlie, giving her the same dark look he'd had since he brought in the doll.
"What is this?"
he asked harshly, and Charlie stared at him, hurt. John looked away with a pained expression, his face flushed. When he looked back at Charlie, the anger in his face had faded, but was not gone.
"I need to know what this is."
"I don't know," she said.
John nodded and sat on the floor with her, carefully leaving a wide space between them. He opened his hand. In it was a small, flat disc. Charlie didn't move to touch it. There was something odd in his manner, something untrusting she had never seen in him before.
"Did you know?"
"No."
Charlie tilted her head, staring at the motionless little girl.
"It's the same as Afton's creatures, though, isn't it?" John said. "Pattern projection, bombarding the mind, overwhelming the senses."
"This one is different, though," Charlie cut in.
She shivered, though she wasn't cold, suddenly unable to shake the memory of the twisted bear, his face stripped to the metal staves, the illusion sparking on and off as he loomed over them.
"Can I see it?" she said, forcing herself back to the present.
John held out the disc, and she took it carefully, watching him warily. He was giving off the sense of a brewing storm, and she was afraid of setting it off. Charlie held the disc up to the light, turning it back and forth, then handed it back.
"That's it?"
John's eyes widened.
"What do you want me to say?" she cried.
"I mean, you can't tell me anything about it?"
"The others all had that inscription, Afton Robotics. This one doesn't, but I'd bet you noticed that."
Actually, I didn't. John looked at her thoughtfully, then back down at the disc. He flipped the switch and Marla yelped in surprise.
Sorry, it's a bit jarring if you aren't expecting it, he said, turning back to Charlie with a grin.
She smiled, and as he met her eyes, his smile faltered, something troubling passing over his face. Before she could speak, it was gone. He grinned widely and winked at her, then flipped the switch. Marla cried out again and Carlton laughed.
Stop doing that!
Marla shouted from several feet away. John ignored her and leaned in closer to Charlie, hesitantly, like he thought she might run away. She turned to face him, a wave of nervousness washing over her. She ducked her head, letting her hair fall over her face, and he reached out and touched it gently, brushing a strand out of her eyes. He gave her a small smile and flipped the switch once, then again.
That's enough, Marla called. This is too weird for me.
John didn't seem to hear her. He was looking at Charlie with a new, troubled expression.
What is it? She asked quietly. Nothing, he said.
He touched her hair again, this time brushing it back from her face and tucking it behind her ear.
Hey, he said abruptly, changing his tone. Do you remember your experiment from last year?
She nodded eagerly, then stopped, freshly aware of how long she had been away.
My faces, but they must be gone. Everything must be gone.
She looked at John with anxious eyes, but he smiled.
Nothing's gone, he said, and her heart lifted. She felt as if he had just given her a gift. Jessica packed up all your stuff. She's got it in her apartment.
Oh, Charlie said, darting her eyes around the room. Jessica? Where is she?
Charlie, John said patiently, and she tried to focus on him.
She could feel her attention waning, as if her mind were spreading thin, floating out like clouds.
The faces, John went on. There was an earpiece so they could recognize you, right?
She nodded.
Could you make it work the other way?
Charlie thought for a moment, then met his eyes again.
You mean, make it so that the animatronics can't see you?
She frowned, her focus returning as she concentrated on the problem. The earpieces emit a frequency that alerts the animatronics to you. It makes you visible. If you inverted that frequency, she paused again.
I don't know if it would work, John.
It might.
It could make us invisible to them?
Maybe, but that's a big leap.
How would I do it? Invert the frequency.
Charlie shrugged. Just switch the wires and...
Charlie, what part of stay in bed wasn't clear?
Marla asked good-naturedly, coming over to them. John stood, his mouth hanging open as though Marla had interrupted Charlie's answer, but she didn't seem poised to add more.
Sorry, he said hastily.
Be careful, Charlie said. She was beginning to feel lightheaded again, and when Marla reached out to help her back to the bedroom, she did not protest. John paused in the door, watching as Charlie curled up on her side, her eyes already closed. Marla raised her eyebrows, and he left, shutting the door halfway. In the living room, Carlton was kneeling beside Ella, now in doll form again, and looking intently into her ear.
Carlton?
John said dubiously, and Carlton sat back on his heels.
Amazing, he said. She looked human, like actually for real a human child.
Yeah, I think that was the idea. Can we talk outside?
John asked brusquely, and Carlton looked at him in surprise.
Sure,
Carlton said with some concern in his voice. Come on. John headed for the door, and Carlton hurried after him. Once they were outside, John looked at Carlton for a moment, thinking.
What's the idea?
Carlton asked with a hint of suspicion.
Let me try to get this straight in my own head first, John said. Last year, when she was still in school, Charlie had this experiment she was doing, something about teaching robots language.
Oh, yeah, Carlton nodded enthusiastically. She told me about it. Natural language programming. They listen to people talking around them and to them, and they learned to talk too. Didn't sound like it worked very well, though.
Well, whatever. She had these earpieces. Like, the robots would only talk to each other. They only recognized each other. You with me so far?
I think.
Well, if you, Carlton, wanted to be in on the conversation, you would need to wear a special earpiece. The earpieces would make them recognize you. Otherwise, you were just part of the background, like they couldn't see you.
Okay. Carlton gave him a puzzled look, and John rolled his eyes.
Wearing the earpieces included you in their conversation. It made you one of them, from their perspective.
Hate to break it to you, but the big ones already see us. At least, I'm pretty sure they do. See this scar?
Will you shut up for a second? John said. I asked Charlie, and she said we might be able to reverse engineer it. We can switch the wires, and instead of the earpieces including us, it would deliberately exclude us.
Carlton furrowed his brow.
It could effectively make us invisible, John prompted.
Switch the wires, Carlton repeated. It would mask us and make us not a part of the world they can perceive.
Right, John nodded.
Carlton waited for John to go on, then added,
What do you want me to do? Go to Jessica's house. She's got all of Charlie's old stuff boxed up in a closet. If she's not there, she leaves her spare key under the welcome mat.
Carlton raised his eyebrows.
Under the welcome mat? That's a horrible place to leave a key.
It's a good neighborhood, John said defensively. Carlton raised his eyebrows.
Yeah, it's a good neighborhood, John. Nothing bad ever happens here.
Carlton slapped John on the shoulder as he headed for his car.
I'm on it, he called.
John let out a sigh, then went back inside. Marla was sitting on the couch, staring at the television, which was not turned on.
How is she? John asked, sitting down beside her, and she shrugged.
Okay, considering the circumstances.
She turned away from the blank screen, looking distressed.
She was locked in a box. That's insane. She was locked in a box. Who knows for how long? Days? Months? She must have been fed, given water, or she'd have starved. But she has no memory of it. She just remembers drifting in and out of sleep. She seems healthy. I don't know what to say.
Impulsively, John hugged her, and she sighed, hugging him back tightly. She released him abruptly, looking away as she brushed at her eyes. John pretended not to see.
Can I go sit with her for a minute? He said when she straightened. I won't bother her. I just want to sit with her and know she's there.
Marla nodded, her eyes brightening with tears again.
Don't wake her up, she admonished as he went to the door.
He nodded and slipped inside, closing the door behind him. Carlton pulled into the lot outside Jessica's apartment building, glancing around for her car. It didn't seem to be there.
Guess I'll be breaking and entering. Sorry, Jess, he said cheerfully as he pulled into a spot,
but a sense of dread had already set in. He wanted company, even on this small errand. Let's see what skeletons Jessica has hiding in her closet. He drummed his hands on the steering wheel, tamping down his nerves, and got out of the car. Jessica lived on the third floor. Carlton had only been to her place once, but he found it again easily. In front of her door was a welcome mat. It was dark green, the word welcome written out in black script. Carlton lifted the mat, but there was nothing under it. For a moment he stared, at a loss for what to do next, then he flipped the mat all the way over. Taped to the center was a key.
"Thought you could outsmart me?" he murmured, peeling off the clear tape. "Can I help you?"
someone asked sternly from behind him. Carlton froze. The voice said nothing else, and so with deliberate movements he finished removing the key, set the mat back on the ground, and smoothed it back into place, trying to seem unconcerned. He put a pleasant expression on his face, stood, and turned to face an elderly man scowling at him from across the hall. He was wearing a faded button-up shirt and holding a hefty book, his finger marking his place.
"Do I know you?"
the man demanded. Carlton forced a grin and waved the key in the air.
"Just visiting," he said. "I'm a friend of Jessica's."
The old man peered at him suspiciously.
"She makes too much noise," he said, and shut his door.
Carlton heard three locks snap into place, then silence. He waited a moment, then turned and hurriedly entered Jessica's apartment. He shut the door carefully behind him and glanced around. The apartment was no bigger, or nicer, than John's, although it was definitely cleaner. Most of the furniture had probably come with the place, but Jessica had determinedly made it her own. The scuffed floor was as spotless as it could be made without an industrial sander, and Carlton looked guiltily down at his sneakers, thinking maybe he should have taken them off outside. Jessica had covered the worn-out couch in fluffy blankets and throw pillows. Her textbooks were lined up neatly on a wide bookshelf made out of brightly painted wood planks, and above the shelf was a large corkboard full of photographs, cards, and ticket stubs. Carlton made his way over to it, curious.
"Let's see what Jessica's been up to," he said, talking to himself just to fill the silence.
The corkboard was full of smiling pictures of Jessica with her friends, a graduation photo with her parents, ticket stubs from concerts and movies, two birthday cards, and a few postcards with enthusiastically and illegibly scribbled notes. Carlton let out a low whistle.
"Somebody's popular," he muttered.
Then something else caught his eye. A child's drawing, pinned to the lower corner of the board. He bent down to look, and his throat caught. It was a crayon drawing of five children, smiling happily as they posed with a big yellow rabbit. In the bottom left corner, the artist had signed his name, and Carlton reached out to touch it lightly.
"Michael," he whispered.
He stared into the bright eyes of the yellow rabbit behind the children, and his mouth went dry.
"If only I could have warned you somehow."
He swallowed and straightened up, turning his attention deliberately back to the photos.
"She sure gets out a lot," he remarked, opening one of the cards to distract himself.
"Happy 15th birthday, Jessica," it read, and he stepped back, feeling slightly ashamed as suddenly he understood. He glanced at the ticket stubs. They were all from shows in New York. The pictures with friends were all a few years old. Jessica's new life here didn't give her much in the way of mementos. Carlton turned away from the corkboard, wishing he had not intruded.
"The closet," he said loudly. "I have to find the closet with the stuff."
There was a kitchenette, and past that a hallway, presumably leading to the bedroom. He found a light switch and flipped it on,
and the closet appeared, halfway down the hall. He opened it, half expecting the contents to come tumbling down on him. But though these were Charlie's possessions, it was Jessica who had done the packing.